Tim, did you notice a lot more pickup trucks up front this morning? Yeah, that's not the way I remember the conversation, my friend. I remember saying anything but country music. No. It's funny how you see all the people from Wisconsin, you know, woo, raising their lighters. There you go. Be a fundraiser. We'll have Budweiser beer downstairs, you know. Yeah, Keystone Light. Sorry, Budweiser's. Budweiser's living high on the hog for them. I could go on, but I'm not gonna. Hey, I wanted to, you know, I know today is Mother's Day, and I know some of you are praying for my mom. I want to say thanks for that. It was an interesting week. Not this week, but the week before, I got a phone call on Thursday, I think, and my mom was having some chest pains. So she went into the clinic, and they did a stress test on her and found out she had some complications of heart disease. And so they'd scheduled a cath lab, which is, now I'm going to, and I got my doctor back there, so she's going to, everything I say is wrong. But they put the balloon in, and they're going to expand the artery, the main artery at the heart. And so we had that scheduled for Tuesday. I went up there Monday night, drove her from Hibbing to Duluth, because Hibbing Hospital is kind of like Hotel California. You check in, but you never check out. Just true. It's so scary when you walk in and that's where the undertaker is taking your size, you know. And anyway, I shouldn't rip on the hospital. It's got one or two good doctors there. It really does. And then it's got other ones that are, whoa, scary. Really scary. So took her out of small town, brought her to this great place. Man, fantastic in Duluth, St. Luke's. Took her down there, got great care. But as we're in the cath lab, as we're in the waiting area, she has a heart attack. We're sitting there, and she's having a heart attack. And pretty mild one at first, but it starts knocking her out. Her BP crashes. They wheel her away. I didn't realize this was happening, but as soon as they wheeled her away, I guess her heart just went boom. But that's a good. I found out that's a good place to have a heart attack, is right there when you're already prepped for getting the balloony thing. And within minutes, they had that balloon thing going, and she received. And as a result, minimal, if any, heart damage whatsoever. So very, very happy about that. It's kind of a bummer of a way to have Mother's Day, you know, this week. But we're very, very grateful. She's 74. She's had diabetes since she's been 24, so 50 years. And that is kind of something that follows with diabetes, is heart disease. And she was told she'd have it after 20 years. It happened after 50 years. So we're very grateful for that. And she got great care. And I'm sure she would have got great care in Hibbing. So that was kind of a mixed blessing. And for us in the Treichler household, growing up in Hibbing, Mother's Day was always a nice day, but it also was a little bit reminiscent. My mom's a diabetic back when it was very difficult to be a diabetic. And I'm not saying if you have diabetes right now, it is still difficult, but it's nothing like it was then. It was back when voodoo science, you really didn't know, just kind of take some insulin and try to figure it out. There really wasn't any other way to monitor it well. And as a result, I'm kind of a medical miracle. I meant to say miracle. In other words, there weren't many women who had diabetes that could have children. And I actually have a brother and sister who I've never met who went full term. Because of that, they were blue babies or they were born. And so I know what Mother's Day is like for some of you. I know it's a hard day. Some of you, it brings back memories of maybe your mom has passed away, or maybe you have had a problem with conception, or maybe with whatever. And I know Mother's Day can be a difficult thing. So I just want to let you know I'm with you on that. We celebrate with those who celebrate. We rejoice with those who are able to rejoice. And we mourn with those who are mourning on this day. So happy Mother's Day with all of that, I wanted to say to you. Now, I want to pick up where that song left off. Okay? And that is the one and only time we'll ever do a country song in this church. Rap, opera, way above country. There you go. Now, I grew up next to WKKQ. Brand new radio station in Hibbing, Minnesota. They put this tower a mile from my house. Every radio station on my radio dial was country. And it was back when it was, "You're cheating, heart." You know, I mean, it was country. And so I have this thing, I have this reflex whenever I hear country. Whenever I go hunting with Dick, with Jim Archer, he plays it. He knows the song, every song. He can sing them. And I pray for him the whole time. So if you like country, it's totally fine. But the song, it says something about relationships, right? There's just something funny about love, right? There's something funny about love in that you just wouldn't go around digging your car keys or taking a Louisville Slugger to just a normal person's car. I hope. At least if you go here, I hope that that's not the way it works out. But what is it about love that causes us to do really strange things? And one of the questions I've been thinking about this week as I've been preparing for this is, why is it that we really hurt the ones we most care about? That doesn't seem to make any sense, but that's the way it works. We really hurt the ones we really care about, and we should just hurt complete strangers, because there's no drama, there's no melodrama, I don't have to deal with it. I just hurt a stranger, and just he can hurt me back, and we're done, right? But we don't. We take shots at those people who are kind of in the inner circle of our lives. And it's bizarre. To quote the great theological and philosophical group, Nazareth, and I quote, "Love hurts. Love scars. Love wounds. And Mars. Anyhow." I'll just read it. You could pray for my family. "Any heart not tough or strong enough to take a lot of pain, take a lot of pain. Love is like a cloud, holds a lot of rain. Love hurts. Ooh, ooh, love hurts." Right? So when we put ourselves in these situations where we become vulnerable with people, and now it actually really hurts. And I really hurt one another. In fact, if you're here this morning, you're just kind of checking out Christianity, you think, you know, I just want to go to a place where people are always nice to each other, and I won't get hurt. And you start getting involved at Hope, and you go, wow, these people are nice, they're friendly. You get involved in a small group, and you're learning more about Christ, and you're going along, and this is great. And then something happens, and somebody takes a shot. If it hasn't happened, you just haven't gotten to know the people in this church well enough yet, or myself. It will happen, and it really hurts because you let your guard down. You do, and it'll happen. And as you get involved in people's lives, as you get involved in relationships, you will get hurt. And a lot of people look and say, I'm done with the church because I had a terrible church experience. And it might have been that, but it also might have been for the first time in your life you were experiencing human community, and yet, because we live in a fallen world, you got a shot. And you weren't expecting that. And you thought, from then on, I'm putting my armor back on. I'm not going to get hurt anymore, ever. And you thought, I'm just leaving. I'm going to go to a different church. And you keep hopping from church to church. And you find something out. There are people in every one of them. And they will hurt you. I'm not making an excuse for Hope. I think Hope's a great church. And yet, I've been hurt by the people of Hope. And I'm sure I've hurt way more than I have been hurt. It just happens in relationships. And that's what I love about the book of Song of Solomon. Here you have, probably, at least in the Bible, one of the most pure and beautiful love stories written about, and yet there's some serious relational fallout, drama, and conflict that happens in this book. Very excited about it. Today we're going to hop over to Song of Solomon chapter 5. You got a Bible with you. You can open up to Song of Solomon chapter 5. We're going to start in verse 2. While you're flipping there, go right basically towards the middle. If you get the Psalms, keep going right. Proverbs, Lamentations, is that right? And then Song of Solomon. Did I do that right? I don't have to sing the whole song to there. I think that's right. Song of Solomon, right in there. And so you can find it. Or you can just grab that insert While they are, I have a couple more. While you're looking, let me say a couple more things. So far in the book of Song of Solomon, we've seen it has been perfect. I mean, seriously, and I know Core took 3 weeks to kind of talk about what happens when it's not perfect, but just kind of forget about Core sermons for a minute and just kind of look at mine, which were perfect. The relationship in Song of Solomon is perfect, right? You see this in the emotional roller coaster we've gone on so far. You see it right in chapter 1 when it starts out. You see her, and the first words in this song, other than, you know, this is Solomon's Song of Songs, it says there's this infatuation she has. Let him kiss me with the kisses of his mouth. She says, she doesn't even know the guy. She's just infatuated with him. Chapter 1, verse 2. And then there's this fear. Chapter 1, verse 1-3, where she says, no wonder all the maidens love you. There's a lot of ladies that like you. Maybe I won't get you. Then she's self-conscious about herself. Remember it? Verse 5, dark am I, yet lovely. Don't look at me because I'm dark. And in that culture, dark skin, and it meant not just because you were dark skin based on your ethnicity, it meant dark skin because you were a common laborer. You worked in the fields. And you had really dark skin because you had really toughened hands. And she was a peasant. She had to work hard. And so she was very self-conscious about this. This also is followed up by mistreatment by her brothers. Remember that in verse 6? She says, my mother's sons were angry with me. They forced me to work out in the vineyards all day long. And so I was forced to work here. And it was mistreatment by her brothers. And yet, she takes the risk. There's this risk she takes. I like this guy. Should I go after him? And she's counseled by the daughters of Jerusalem. Go and graze your sheep by the tents of the shepherds. Get yourself in his way. It's kind of cool, right? She takes this risk. But every one of these things in the book of Song of Solomon resolves itself in the book. So you see, first of all, you see this infatuation, it resolves itself with love, right? She says in chapter 2, after he's committed to her, it says that his banner over me is love. This military banner idea that I feel now safe and sound in his love. It says that in chapter 2, that's chapter 2, verse 4, chapter 2, verse 16, there's this fear that he wouldn't be hers. My lover is mine and I am his. 2 verse 16. It goes on then to where, instead of being self-conscious, where she says, I'm dark am I yet lovely? And she says, you know what? I'm just one of the lilies of the entire valley. Yes, I'm lovely, but I'm one lily. And he responds back with a great line in chapter 2, verse 2, where he says, yeah, you are just one of the lilies, but to me, baby, you are a lily and the rest are thorns. Your lily among the thorns is my beloved. And it's like, oh, that's a great, great line. Especially, guys, if you can take her poetry and flip it, I'm talking score. It's a good, good move. And he does that. He is able to use that same analogy. And she uses that then throughout the rest of the book, even talking about that whole thing. And this whole idea of mistreatment. Now it's replaced with, by the time we get to where he's giving the wedding processional, and you know it's debatable whether he's going out to get her or he's coming, one or the other, it doesn't really matter, but it shows clearly in chapter 3, verse 7, when he's doing this, there's this carriage and there's 60 warriors around it. She is going to be protected from any mistreatment or any harm whatsoever. And this risk then leads to reward. Chapter 4, 16. We saw this last week when we talked about the wedding night and biblical, passionate, and appropriate letting the dogs go lovemaking. So what does it look like? And you remember, it's very tasteful, but it's also very open. A beautiful section of scripture, chapter 4. And in that, she says at the very end, she says, awake, north wind. In other words, where she'd been saying for the whole rest of the book, hold on, do not arouse or awaken love before it's time. Do not arouse love or awaken it before it's time. And then she now says, the reward is, I'm going to awaken this. I want this to be. That's the emotional roller coaster, and it's all been resolving. It's been beautiful. And you think in some ways the book should just stop here. Man, am I glad it doesn't, though. Because we see this week that it goes to relational drama. There's some relational drama. Now, they don't, in this particular account, they never are in the same room. But if they were, it would look like that. Talk to the hand. Go ahead, keep talking there, son, but talk to the hand. That's what it's going to look like. And that gives me encouragement. Because I know we want the other, but in a fallen world, we end up going this other route. And so if that's the case, and that will be the case if you get involved in relationships, then why bother? Right? Well, because you're designed for them, and to obey God, you need to be in relationship with Him and other people. And it will be hard. Love hurts. Great theologian. Nazareth, right? Listen to what C.S. Lewis says about this. And if you I love C.S. Lewis, you know that. Listen to what he says about this. He says, I am a safety first creature. Of all arguments against love, none makes so strong an appeal to my nature as careful. This might lead you to suffering. To my nature, my temperament, he says, I say yes to that. But not to my conscience. I can't do that with my conscience. When I respond to that appeal, the one that says stay away, I seem to myself to be 1,000 miles away from Christ. If I am sure of anything, I am sure that his teaching was never meant to confirm my congenital preference for safe investments and limited liabilities. In other words, he's saying, I have a congenital, meaning an ingrain or what I do naturally. I will stay away from them because it's going to hurt. And he says, Christ never taught that. He taught opening yourself up and going towards it. He says, I doubt whether there is anything in me that pleases him less. There is no safe investment. To love at all is to be vulnerable. Love anything and your heart will certainly be wrung and possibly be broken. If you want to make sure of keeping it intact, you must give your heart to no one, not even to an animal. Wrap it carefully round with hobbies and little luxuries. Avoid all entanglements. Lock it up safe in the casket or coffin of your selfishness. But in that casket, safe, dark, motionless, airless, it will change. It will not be broken. It will become unbreakable, impenetrable, irredeemable. The alternative to tragedy in relationships, or at least to the risk of tragedy, is damnation. The only place outside heaven where you can be perfectly safe from all the dangers and perturbations. That's how smart the guy is. It just means the cause of trouble or these things that perturb you. All the dangers of that word, of love, is hell. I guess it's I can't even say it. Phonetically, write it down so I can say it. Okay, now, what's he saying here? He's saying if you want to protect yourself from this, what that is not protection. You'll just become hardened. But if you open yourself up to it, you will find life, but you will get hurt. Those are your choices. That's it. Those are the choices. And with that, let's take a look at what happens to this beautiful love story. And now it's going to hit reality time. Here we go. Song of Solomon 5, starting in verse 2. Now, instead of just reading the passage through, I'm gonna kind of make some comments along the way as we go through it the first time. Because it's kind of a drama and it kind of unfolds and I want you to follow it. And then I'm going to stop and take a look and make some observations of what's going on. Why did this happen? And how do you fix it? That's what I'm going to go at this morning. So, Song of Solomon 5, verse 2. Calling this part, the request. It says, I slept, but my heart was awake. Listen, my lover is knocking. All right, let's just stop right there for a second. It says, I slept, but my heart is awake. So, what's going on here? I don't know. I really don't know. It's so funny. You read commentaries, and one says, this is clearly a dream sequence. It says clearly she's having a dream about this situation. That literally, the next one I looked at yesterday, it said, anyone who takes this dream as a dream, it's just folly. And then they go on. It's like, you dudes should sit in that. I'd like to see this cage match, a little UFC with these guys going at it. They just totally disagree. So here's what the options are, and I think we can resolve this to some degree. One, it could be a dream. She's having a dream about this situation. The second thing is it could actually happen. Now, both of those, as we're going to see in this passage, there's some problems with that. It especially when we get to next week and you talk about the resolution of this conflict, how it works out, that it just seems strange that it's a dream. But some of the stuff that happens seems very fanciful. It just doesn't seem like, how can that possibly be true? So it could be just symbolic that she's writing about a situation, a conflict they had. I'm going to take it this way, and then I think it'll solve all that. I'm going to take it as if it really happened and just kind of walk through what the poetry is trying to tell us and extract the principles from it and say, that's what we're trying to get here. Now, whether or not it actually happened or not, I don't know. It's poetry. You know, you can just say that throughout the whole book. I don't know. It's poetry. But what is it trying to teach me? And that's where we're going to go. So here's what's happening. She's asleep. She's late at night. She could be sleeping, but her heart was awake. So either she really is awake or she's dreaming, but it's middle of the night. Okay, we got that much straight. And here's what happened. Her lover is knocking at the door. Okay, so he's outside. She's inside. Now that just in and of itself is weird because he's king and why would he not have the key to the palace? That just doesn't work. But just work with me here, okay? It's poetry, all right? It's poetry. We're just going to let it stand for what it is. He's outside knocking. It's late at night. And here's what he says. Open to me, my sister, my darling, my dove, my flawless one. Remember that. It'll be important later. My head is drenched with dew, my hair with the dampness of the night. Okay, so let's work ourselves up. What's going on? It's the middle of the night. Where's Solomon? He's outside. Where has he been? He's been outside. Why? Because his head is drenched with dew, his hair with the dampness. He's been out until the middle of the night. What's he doing? He's playing poker with the guys or something. I don't know what he's doing out late at night, but it's the middle of the night and he hasn't been with her. So now he's, you know, it's after hours and he's trying to ask the warden, can I come in? Knocking on the door. And you're going to see that she's not really pleased with this. She's not pleased with the fact that he was out all night, basically. And now, middle of the night or early in the morning, he's knocking on the door. She's not really happy with that. And look at what he calls her. We'll make more of this later. He says, my sister, my darling. Go back one. Oh, there we go. My dove and my flawless one. That's what he calls her. We'll make a lot of that later. But for right now. Now, we don't know this yet, but I'm just going to tell you now. You're going to see it clearly later. He is making an advance on her. He's making a sexual advance. So there's some time that's passed between 5-1 when their honeymoon night, and now it's life is real. He's knocking on the door, and he's saying, how you doing? And she's going to reply back like this. The answer is, and these are some of the most interesting excuses in the world, all right? I guess the headache wasn't invented yet or something, but she says, well, I've taken off my robe. Do I have to put it on again? And I've washed my feet. Must I soil them again? I mean, the bedroom is here. He's knocking. I got to put on my robe. I mean, it's a long ways to the door. Or, you know, my feet, in that culture, you'd wash your feet right before bed so they'd be nice and clean. You're in your bed. You don't want to get your bed all messed up. But just the floor between there, she's worried about getting it. I mean, she's totally making excuses. What's beneath this? I'm angry at you. Why weren't you here? Why don't you come to bed like when you're supposed to? Not now. Okay, keep going. He doesn't take no for an answer, and he tries to kind of barge his way in. Now, I know, it's hard to think. How does King Solomon not have a key? This is where, again, could be a dream. How does this happen? He says, my lover thrust his hand through the latch opening. My heart began to pound for him. All right, this is a little tricky, but there would be like some type of a latch opening or something. It'd be open up enough possibly to get his hand into there. Not enough for him to get around and get to unlock it. So it's enough so he can kind of work it up. They had keys in those days. Some of them were like 2 feet long. Imagine having a set of keys, you know, banging it. Okay, so but there would be keys to these doors, and it could be that. He's putting his hand through, trying to force his way in. This is going to be significant when we remember what happened in chapter 4. He wants to get his way in, and then it says, my heart began to pound for him. Very hard to translate this. If you have an English Standard Version, they say my heart was thrilled for him. That's probably what it really doesn't mean. No offense to that version, but it really means, this is what literally means, my bowels were quaking. Now, how do you translate that, right? My bowels were quaking. I know how I would translate that, but that certainly isn't what this means. So, in other words, there's something, I don't think it's excitement that he's coming. It's more like either anger or frustration or something that's going on here that it's not necessarily a positive response. My heart began to pound for him. It's not in a desirous way. It's more like saying, yeah, put your hand in there, big shooter. Now, here's the deal. Does anybody remember why it's significant that he's trying to back up there, Sunshine. There you go. Does anybody remember why it's significant for him to try to open the door, given what happens in chapter 4? She's described as a what in chapter 4? Remember? A garden that is what? The gate is locked to the garden. Who has the key? She does. He doesn't do anything. He says, when you open the key, and she does open the garden. Here she says, no. I don't want to put my robe on. No, you're not getting in. And it does mean physically, but it means in a lot of ways. I'm upset with you. You're staying out. Okay? And he this time doesn't wait. He tries to demand his way in. Okay? Now it's not just in a sexual way, in every way. I'm going to get my way. So she then changes her mind. Some time passes. She changes her mind. And it says in verse 5, I arose to open for my lover. And then it says, and my hands dripped with myrrh, my fingers with flowing myrrh on the handles of the lock. So what happens is myrrh was used as a way of festival, of showing excitement, of being around someone and making a party. And he wanted it that way. And that was his desire for the evening. And so he put that on the handle. And so she got that. She could see his intention. All right? She comes there and does that. Verse 6, the opportunity then is lost, though. I opened for my lover, but my lover had left. He was gone. So he doesn't get what he wants. Come over here. She won't come to the door. He tries to get in. That doesn't work. So some time passes. He pouts, he leaves. It says my heart sank at his departure. In other words, that I was. Some of the versions even say I felt like I could die. That's how it just. I felt that rotten now that he's gone. And then it says he's went so far away that she looks for him, but she can't find him. And it says I called for him, so she's yelling, but he did not answer. So either he is far away, or he's not even going to answer when she's yelling for him. That's the little boy he's turned into, okay, in this whole thing. This is beautiful. I'm so glad this is in this book, because it's like, oh, man, you've done everything right now, and you are a putz right now. Can't believe you are a jerk. Gosh, I can't believe this. This goes on then in this bizarre sequence where these watchmen are around. In verse 6-7, it says, the watchmen found me as they made their rounds in the city. They beat me, they bruised me, they took away my cloak, those watchmen of the walls. Now, this is where it gets bizarre, okay? Did it actually happen? This is where it gets weird if it actually happened. Because you're telling me that the queen is out and the watchmen put a beating on her. It's just weird, okay? So, but what are watchmen there for? They have two jobs. They're to watch and they're to be men. No. They're or women, I guess, watch peoples, we'd say today. But their job was is to protect. And what do? They don't protect. Instead, they beat her and they steal from her. Now, here's what's at least symbolically being talked about. Clearly. Symbolically, remember where she felt vulnerable? My brothers mistreated me. Right? And then that changes. If you look at chapter 3, verse 7, it says, when he brings that carriage, I talked about it just a minute ago, he says, look, it is Solomon's carriage escorted by 60 warriors. the noblest of Israel, and all of them wearing the sword, all experienced in battle, each with his sword at his side, prepared for the terrors of the night. This is one of those terrors of the night. Where are the 60 guys? They're gone with Solomon. His leaving, his departing, has now put her in danger. And she gets a beating, and she gets things stolen from her, from the very people who were to protect her. This leads her to then finding the daughters of Jerusalem in the song. And she says, "O daughters of Jerusalem, I charge you, if you find my lover, what will you tell him? Tell him that I'm faint with love. Tell him that I'm lovesick." That's what some of the versions say. And so she now is desperate to find him. You can hear that desperation. I can't find him. Where is he? This whole thing's gone south. Then the daughters of Jerusalem now say to her something that they've never said before. Before, they've been encouraging her and building her up in this relationship. And now this is the first time they're going to say, "Hey, you know what? Is this guy really worth it?" That's what they're going to say. "How is your beloved better than others? If he treats you like that, what's wrong with him? Treat you like that? Most beautiful woman, how's your beloved better than others that you charge us so? That we should tell him, this jerk, that we should tell him that you're lovesick." And then she's going to go on and she's going to say, "Yes, but he's my beloved." And she's going to list a physical description of him. But unlike the physical description we just saw on the wedding night where he describes her, unlike that one where it's anticipation and joy, this one is sorrowful because their relationship, even maybe just momentarily, we're going to see the resolution next week, has been broken because of his actions and her response. It's broken. So as she's saying this, it's more of love lost, or at least love not the way it's supposed to be. She describes him and she says, "My lover is radiant and ruddy, outstanding among 10,000. His head is purest gold. His hair is wavy and black as a raven. His eyes are like doves by the water streams, washed in milk, mounted like jewels. His cheeks are like beds of spice, yielding perfume. His lips are like lilies, dripping with myrrh. His arms are rods of gold, set with chrysolite." So the gun show is on, right? He's got huge pipes, massive. "His body is like polished ivory, decorated with sapphire." He's got a six-pack like this. Okay. That wasn't supposed to be funny. All right. "His legs are pillars of marble. He's a muscular man set on bases of pure gold. His appearance is like Lebanon, choice as its cedars." Lebanon was known for having these huge, beautiful trees that were majestic. Part of the region, they smell good and they were very, very strong trees. "His appearance is like the choicest cedars. His mouth is sweetness itself. He is altogether lovely. Strength and honor belong to this guy. This is my lover. This is my friend. O daughters of Jerusalem." And he's gone. He's left. There's relational tension, relational conflict. Things are not the way they're supposed to be. So, what do you do with that? That's the scripture. What happened? How did we get here? Let's go one layer down, and then I want to go another layer down. First layer down. What happened? And it's clearly this: selfishness. Selfishness kicked in. And I want to talk to you about, from this passage, of five ways to be a selfish pig. Can you see that well enough? A selfish pig. Wow. I'm not going to use my good stuff on you guys anymore. That's it. Forget it. I actually just Googled selfish pig and this came up and I chuckled. So I thought, they will too. I was wrong. Okay, so number one, let's talk about this. Let's kind of remind some of the things that happened in the story, the account, and kind of talk about five things that went wrong and five ways. If you want to be a selfish pig, here's five ways to do it from the passage. Passage teaches it. Let's show it. Number one, put your desires, put your needs above everyone else's. All right? Yes, last week we talked about your passions, your desires, your needs being like a dog, all right? And And there are times to have the dog on the leash and say, hey, I'm taking you for a walk here. And there are times in appropriate places to take the dog off the leash. And we talk about the wedding night was one of those opportunities to awake and arouse love and the whole thing. And that's great. But we talk about oftentimes those things need to be on the leash. And here's one of my contentions. Here's one of the things that I think. Why do we hurt the people that we love? Because I think that when I'm in my house, when I'm in my home, it's time just to run around. It's an off-leash area all the time. And we do this sometimes in the name of authenticity. Hey, I'm just being real. And that's a code word for just saying, well, I just whatever I feel like, that's what I'm going to do. I'm not going to restrain. I'm not going to have self-control because this is what I do when big dog's off the leash, this is how I run. This is how I roll. Okay, and that we have this idea that with people that we know, we can just let the dog off the leash all the time. Yesterday, I'm preparing this message. I'm sitting here writing a message on selfishness, on how not to be selfish. It'll get there, believe me. How not to do this. And the phone rings, and it's Carol. And she's preparing this nice meal for us. And she says, could you snap the beans and put them in water and cook them up? Because I'm bringing home Dave. And she's running around everywhere, taking care of all this stuff so I can have some time alone. And admittedly, there were some frustrations in what had happened. She didn't know that I had some frustrations right when the phone rang. And I just said, no. No, I don't want to do that. We are naturally selfish pigs, okay? We, all of us, we just naturally selfish pigs. Why? Because I want to do what I want to do, when I want to do it, how I want to do it. And if you run in the way with that, big dog's off the leash, watch out. And I'm sitting there thinking, gosh, she's went to all this trouble. She asked me to snap some freaking beans. Go and snap the freaking beans. Put them in water and do the hard job of actually turning on the stove, you idiot. You non-contributing zero. And I did. Okay, I did. So I get 1 point, but I lost 10,000. All right, so I'm those keeping score at home. So that's who we are. That's the way we roll. And that's what he does. What does he say? Hey, I know I've been out all night hanging with my buddies. I know you'd rather have had me home. Maybe it was a stress to do that. But hey, baby, open the door. Open the door. Come on now, honey. His desires above hers. Number two, be manipulative. Be manipulative. You can see this in what he does here. I told you to pay attention. He calls her four things. He's out late at night, all night long perhaps. He's hanging out there. What does he call her? This is classic. This is classic. He says to her, open to me, my sister, which is implications of, hey, we have a covenant bond here. We have a legal, we're legally bound here. So you should open to me, my darling, my dove, my flawless one, my pookie. Okay, I added that one, but that's what it is. It's like, it's just buttering her up. My flawless one, my sister, my lovely, all this. We are manipulative in our speech. How to be a selfish pig. When you say something to people, are you saying it to them? If it's a positive thing, so that they say something back? Stay there, Todd. Go back one. Are we saying something so they go and we want them to say something back? Do you say, man, that's a great looking shirt you got there because you want them to say something about your shirt? Is that what you want? That's manipulation. Do you say, I love you because you want to have them say, I love you back. In fact, there's even a way of saying it. I love you. Waiting for something else to come. Do you give compliments away? What's your motive here? Is it so you're getting something? Well, then it's what you're really saying. If you just wrote down what they're actually saying is, I want you to tell me that I love you. Okay? But we're manipulative. A lot of us are going to go over to family today. Some of you will go and visit your mom or visit your grandmother, whatever. And say grandma makes mashed potatoes. And grandma used to make great mashed potatoes. But those days are long gone. They're long gone. They are lumpy. They are cold. They are bad. Okay, they're just bad. And grandma will ask you, how are the mashed potatoes? And the right answer is, grandma, I love you. But if I did time in federal prison, I could get better mashed potatoes than these. Okay, maybe not that blunt, but you have to be honest and say, Grandma, I love you. Your mashed potatoes, not so much. Manipulation, we do it. We hear it. We respond to it. It's this way of relating, and that's what he does. Ways to be a selfish pig. Number three, third way, is they use the indirect speech thing, right? Instead of saying, I'm upset with you. You were gone all night. Now you come and you knock on the door and you expect me to get out of bed and perhaps you want to have sex with me or whatever. And that's what you want? Come on. She doesn't say that. She says, you know, I got to go get my robe. Or maybe my feet might get dirty. Okay? And I grew up in a typical home in Minnesota. In Minnesota, we call indirect speech talking. Okay? We're masters of this. We don't say anything straight. We say it a little bit differently. Now, I grew up in a part of the state where that's not true, but my parents aren't from there. My mom especially. My dad used to have a great line. He used to say, when we were all sitting at the table, he'd say, well, while you're up, go and get the milk. I'd be like, no, I'm still sitting here. And he'd say, well, you'll be up when you go get the milk, right? It's beautiful. Or the old, and those of you who come from typical Norwegian homes, no, you have to ask three times, right? The three times rule. If you don't know that and you go visit a Norwegian, it's unbelievably offensive. Three times. And if you take anything before the third time, it's very rude. They'll ask you, would you like some more beans? You say, no, no. Oh, really? You can have some more beans. No, no, I'm fine. Oh, no, I'd love to give you some beans. Okay, I'll take some beans. If you want beans, that's the way the game is played. Ah. So my mom visits my dad the first time she went there, and my grandmother said, would you like some more beans, or whatever it was. She said, no. My grandma said, okay. It went on. Afterwards, my mom said, I can't believe how rude your mom is. Why? Because she didn't offer me any more beans. Yeah, she did. I was there. She only said it once. Yeah, it's kind of the way we roll around here. We ask you if you want beans, and we're kind of expecting an answer. This whole indirect speech thing is, and people joke about it, but be very, very careful with it. It's basically a way of never saying exactly what your expectations are. Well, if I had to say, then, you know, if I tell you, that's no good, because you should just figure it out. I'm just going to say to the ladies, we can't figure it out. Okay, it's not an inability, like we're not trying hard enough. It's just that chip does not exist. We don't own that chip. He's like, that's what we heard when you're giving us hints. I don't have it. Fourth way to be selfish. Pout and withdraw. That's David. No. What does he do? He tries to get woo her in by words. That doesn't work. He tries to manipulate the latch. That doesn't work. So what does he do? He runs away like a five-year-old child. He runs away. He pouts. I'm going to get my way. I'm going to go now. I know I'm the king of the whole nation of Israel, but I didn't get my way. I'm going to go. And he pouts and he runs away. Now, it is amazing to me how as adults, and especially in relational conflict, how we turn into three-year-olds. And it all boils down to three-year-olds. As I watch my kids, and you can just see the problems in the sandbox or with one another, you can see that's exactly the way. I'm more sophisticated at it, but it's basically this. And that's why I put this picture up there, because we're being a big baby. That's what selfish pigs are. They're big babies. They don't get their way. I'm out of here. I'm taking my ball. I'm going home. And that leads to then this danger that he puts her in, this failure to champion or protect her. He's just a coward. And he runs away from it. He leaves her in a situation where she gets beat up by these guys. The king's wife, she gets beat up by these guys and she gets her cloak stolen. He's just a failure to care about others because, oh, I didn't get my way. I don't care. I'm going to leave you in harm's way. And we do that. We leave people in harm's way. Now, those are five ways. You want to be a selfish pig? from this passage, those are five ways to be a selfish pig from this. Now, how do you not be a selfish pig? Well, just don't do those five things, right? Wrong. This is a church. This is a church. It's a Christian church. For me to just tell you don't do those five things is moralism. That's not why you came to a Christian church. That's not how you overcome it. Because every day that you wake up, you are naturally, no offense, but you are a selfish pig. How do you overcome every single day of your life thinking about you? In other words, what I think is the layer below this layer. So what's happening? Here's this account. What's the layer here? Selfishness. How do you overcome selfishness? You got to go to the root of it. And what's the root of it? There's idolatry going on. What is the idolatry that's happening? Okay? What's the idolatry to selfishness? How is my heart being wooed by selfishness instead of what it should be? How am I bowing down to the idol of selfishness? What's going on? And I think it's like this. Here's a picture of the solar system, all right? There's the sun, and there are nine planets. Yes, Pluto is a planet, okay? I learned it as a kid. It's still a planet. Can I get an amen on that? Pluto, planet, take a vote. All in favor, say aye. Aye. Pluto's a planet, all right? You can see it. It's a little dot. It's out there. It's a planet. It's got the little ring around it. It's got to be a planet. Okay. Now, when Copernicus discovered that the Earth wasn't the center of our Milky Way, but the sun was, everything changed for him. Because before that time, they thought the Earth was the center of the universe, or at least of our galaxy. And they found out that, no, actually it's not. It's the sun. Now, here's the contention. For each one of us, that's a picture of me in 05. Thank you. Thank you very much. So I manipulated you to say that, but it's okay. I wanted that. What happens is we put ourselves as the center. Why? Because 24/7 I live up here. Believe me, it's a scary place to live up here. You live in your own little scary place called your mind. The center of my consciousness is me. Okay, that's just a duh, right? It's the center of you. You walk around with you all day. You're thinking about you because you are it, because that's the center of your consciousness. And when you, that's what it is. That's what it just means to be a person, right? I don't have Calvin as my center of consciousness, and he doesn't have me, and same vice versa. We all have our own mind in our own brain. Okay, that's simple. But what happens, though, is when all of a sudden now I become the center of everything, and that's how I'll naturally go. Because when I wake up in the morning and have back pain, nobody else in the house goes, ouch, right? I do. So then it just starts to slip into all kinds of other things, and pretty soon my center of consciousness needs to be the most important thing. I slip into selfishness. How do you overcome this idol? How do you overcome the idol? That's the root of what happened, at least in this relational conflict. How do you overcome the root, this root idol of selfishness? And here's my contention. It starts because you have to put something else where the sun is. Proverbs 1:7, a passage we looked at when we started this series, we looked at wisdom literature, says this: the fear of the Lord is the beginning of knowledge. But fools despise wisdom and discipline. What you and I need to have every day is a Copernican revolution, which basically is, I'm not the center. The earth isn't the center. God is the center. The fear of the Lord, seeing who God is and putting him at the center of our lives and realizing, oh, I revolve around him. Even though everything in my being is trying to tell me everything revolves around me, the reality is it revolves around God. And God is the center. The fear of the Lord is the beginning of knowledge. But fools despise that. Wisdom, discipline, they always slip into, what are my passions? How can I let the dog off the leash? It's all about me. Become the me monster, right? Fools despise wisdom and discipline. Let me give you an account in the Old Testament that shows this really clearly. The prophet Isaiah when he was just called to the beginning of his ministry, had this experience that took it away from him and made God the center. Isaiah 6, chapters or verses 1 to 8 says, "In the year that King Uzziah died, I saw the Lord seated high on a throne, high and exalted, and the train of his robe filled the temple. Above him were seraphs, each with six wings. With two wings they covered their faces, with two they covered their feet, with two they were flying, and they were calling to one another, 'Holy, holy, holy is the Lord Almighty. The whole earth is full of his glory.' At the sound of their voices, the doorposts and the threshold shook, and all the temple was filled with smoke." So what happens to Isaiah? He gets an image, a vision of God that blows his mind and takes him off the center of the universe and puts God there. Oh my gosh, that's who God is. High, exalted, powerful, holy, majestic. Train of the robe fills the whole thing. And it's powerful. It says, with that, the voice, the sound of their voices, the doorpost, everything shook. And what happens is, Isaiah, for that brief moment, loses himself. He's looking at God, and he says, "Whoa, look at who God is." And we just so seldom have that opportunity to get outside ourselves. It's all about me and what I'm experiencing, even what I'm feeling about this. You may be doing it right now. You're either engaged or boring. How is a sermon boring? Well, who cares? It's not about you. It's about God and what's going on. Maybe I'm right now, by doing this, I'm thinking about me instead of just God. That's how you overcome it. You put God in the center. Isaiah then responds back. He says, "Woe is me." He looks at himself after seeing who God is, and he no longer says, "Look at me, I'm the captain of my own ship, and I'm a good guy," and all. He says, "Woe is me," basically because I'm a sinner. "I'm ruined, for I'm a person of unclean lips, and I live among a people of unclean lips, and my eyes now have seen the King, the Lord Almighty." When he puts him in his proper place, he now realizes his sin and how far the distance is, and he starts to get a proper perspective. And that is a gift, ladies and gentlemen. That is a gift of God, that you can see yourself not as a sinner anymore, but as someone who needs rescuing from God. Which leads to the next thing. One of the seraphs comes and takes a live coal from with a live coal in his hand, which he'd taken from the tongs from the altar. So it's this place where sacrifice is made. A huge foreshadowing of what's going to happen at the cross when Jesus Christ takes your sin. "With it he touched my lips and says this, 'See, this has touched your lips. Your guilt is taken away and your sin atoned for,' because of what God did, not because of what Isaiah did. And then, now he's set free to no longer be selfish. Because God says, who shall I send? And who will go out for us on this mission that I have?" And Isaiah says, "Sign me up. Here am I, send me. I've overcome selfishness to the point I want to serve you, I want to serve others." You cannot become unselfish by putting a little piece of paper in your wallet or purse that says, "Today, don't be selfish." You can't. The way you stop being selfish is you get the fear of the Lord. And when that grips you and changes you, you realize, "I'm not the center. He's the center. Now, now I've got true north again. Which way am I going?" Jesus said it this way. In Matthew chapter 16, he says this to his disciples. "If anyone would come after me, he must deny himself, take up his cross, and follow me." You need a new Lord in your life, and it's not you. Deny yourself, die to yourself, take up a cross, and then follow me as the King of all. Put me as the center. Whoever wants to save his life will lose it. Whoever loses his life for me will find it. In other words, if you're about self-preservation, selfishness, you will just find yourself getting more frustrated and more frustrated and more frustrated. But if you decide to put Jesus Christ at the center and say, "God, you're so awesome," and then you will find it. Your life, you'll now have life. You'll be set free from selfishness. So I just want to close this morning by asking you a hard question. This morning, right here, right now, not 5 years ago, not 10 years ago, who is on the throne of your life? You or Christ? Let's pray together. Jesus, I just confess that if no one else needed to hear this message today, I did. I think in 20 plus years of marriage, I have learned how incredibly selfish I am. And God, on our own, we are just selfish people looking out for our own interests. So God, I pray for a gift this morning. I pray for a gift that may be painful at first, but just like Isaiah would set us free. God, would you give us a vision of you that far exceeds any vision of ourselves on the throne? But I pray that especially for people who have been churchgoers for a long time. Can hear a message like this, and it's just one more message. Lord Jesus, would you shock us into realizing that we're like Solomon. We're just selfish pigs, caring just about ourselves. Would you shock us with that this morning? Would that be a gift you could give to us, Lord? Give us a vision of yourself, and then give us a vision of the cross and the forgiveness that we have in it that is just breathtaking because of how beautiful you are. We wouldn't take that lightly. We'd realize how sinful we are. If nothing else, our selfishness, the idol of selfishness. So God, I pray for that you grant us that gift this morning so that we can be set free to be unselfish and have relationships the way we're supposed to. But it has to go that way. It just cannot start by not being selfish. It has to start by your transforming vision of how mighty and powerful you are. So would you give that to us as a gift? Whether it's for the very first time in our lives this morning, where we bend our knee to you and put you on the throne and become a follower of you, or whether it's for the thousandth time and we bend our knee and become a follower of you. Would you do that, Lord? We pray in Jesus' name. Amen.